seated. 50 ways to get your money. You notice that this is not only Thanksgiving weekend, but it is also the beginning of pledge time in the fall at Christ Church and most churches around our diocese and other places. We come in the fall and we're getting ready to get your money. 50 ways. Now, this is not to be confused with 50 ways to leave your lover or 50 shades of gray, just so you know. Money. We're going to spend a little more time just sharing some things that I simply know from my varied experience around money. But money and the way we deal with it is a very cultural matter, and it's very sensitive in some ways to us, and the things that we like about it, things we don't like about it. We like some of the ways that people give and that people get our money, and we don't like other ways that happens. But culture changes. You know that back in the 1950s, a preacher could get up and preach about money, but he could never talk about sex, or she could never talk about sex. Today, you can talk about sex in the pulpit anytime you want to, but you can't talk about money. It's far too sensitive for that. So things have changed. And, but there are ways in which I'm describing this to help you kind of locate yourself in this whole matter of how we get money and how it is moved from one pocketbook to another and that sort of thing. In our mainline churches that you and I are familiar with, Anglican, Presbyterian, United, and so on, we usually have collection plates, and we come right down and put it right under your nose and ask you to put some money into it. And so we try to be polite about that, but that's the way we do it. And besides that, we have pledges so that you can pledge now so that we can plan our budget for next year. We have fundraisers, we have bazaars, we sell food, and we sell our second-hand stuff, and we do all sorts of things to kind of fill out the budget. And we have automatic withdrawals, you know, now so that you don't even have to put your money in. Actually, that has become so uncomfortable that I was in a Presbyterian church not long ago where they actually have little cards, and maybe you've seen them, out at the, there's a basket out front. And if you do automate, I mean, it's terrible to come into church and have the plate pass in front of you and your neighbor, and they say you didn't put a darn thing in there. And the feeling is that maybe you're just a little too stingy to do it. So you put a little card in. It says, I gratefully and thankfully support the ministry of Christ Memorial Church. And so you feel very good that you had done something that, in case anybody is looking, you know how it goes. I wanted to tell you one little anecdote. It happened last Easter in this church. And after the service, I was talking to a gentleman on the front steps, a guest, and I think it's his mother-in-law who is a member of this church, and he made mention of that, but he said, I have a little bit of advice. He said, I noticed when you took up the offering, he said, you don't have enough ushers here, because he said, you start here and you kind of get, the plate has to get clear around, and it has to do fast, and so, I noticed, he said, the plate went so fast that there were a number of guests here, he says, and I was prepared, but a number of them weren't, and they started fishing in their purse and their pocket to get some money out, but by the time they did, the plate had already gone by. He said, slow it down. He said, give them time. He said, they're people who want to give, you know. They're not a member of this church, but they want to give. Slow it down. He said, you'll get more money. I just looked at him and said, you're not an Anglican, are you? And he paused and said, no. He said, but I used to be. He said, I'm a Pentecostal. And that just tells you how different our attitude towards money is. They're not afraid. They just simply go after it. Money, you see, in some cultures and in some church cultures, is far more public than what we would think of. In colonial times in the United States back in the 1700s, didn't take up any offering at all because the state church took care of that for you. You would have box pews and you'd pay rental for that so they would get money for that. And then you'd have the poor box, which is what we today call our discretionary fund. And so there's money that goes into that to help the poor that's over and above the budget. Some of you remember St. Paul's Darien, the Episcopal, Anglican Episcopal Church down in the States. Many of you, Gene went there, and some others had gone there. Well, they had their regular Sunday morning service, but Sunday night was a big event. Terry Fullen would be preaching, and so people came in from all over the area, and lots of students and so on. So it was a kind of a large the place would be full. And Terry, I remember announcing, because I pastored only 25 miles away and back and forth a lot, and I knew Terry very well from college days. But he said, anybody, offering time, anybody here who has a need, he said, feel free when the offering plate comes around and the rest of it putting in to take out up to $20 if you need it. Now, in that particular community, if you know it, these are not people you'd think that would need it, but there were a lot of students there. And I sat there and I would watch every now and again. Somebody took out a $10 or $20 bill, and there's usually a young person, so it would be a student who'd do it. Now, that's kind of an unusual way to do things, but that's another way which I saw that sort of thing happen. Excuse me. You go into an African-American church. Both Africans and African-Americans culturally tend to be very open and very public around money, unless they've been shaped by their Anglican tradition, and then they kind of cool back quite a little bit. But when I was in Ghana, I watched this. The offering time was the most celebratory moment in the whole worship. They've used, and many Pentecostals and other churches use the synagogue method that goes way, way, way back, even to biblical times, where you didn't take up the claim. We take up the collection because we don't trust the people to come forward, frankly, and we want to get every nickel we can get out of you. But in that case, people come forward, and I was brought up in a church like that, that the tithes were for Sunday morning. People would come forward and place their money in a large offering plate up here. And many African-American churches would do the same thing. excuse me. But in Ghana, I was in a Methodist cathedral. I was in a Pentecostal church, and I was in one of the independent, indigenous, if you like, African churches. And in all three cases, the offering plate box was up here, and in the bigger churches, like the Methodist Cathedral and the Pentecostal Church, it has a stand, and it had about five different containers on it, and each one was for a different thing. One was for the general, the budget. One might have actually been for the minister's salary. Another one would have been for the property, possibly the building fund. And one would be for missions. And so you got to know what went into each container. It wasn't marked. But they would come forward. But that's when the music came out, and that's when they began to not walk down the aisle, but they danced down the aisle. And they took their time dancing down the aisle. And they put their offering, and they took their time getting back. They just kept dancing. It was the most dancing moment in the whole worship service. And I asked a professor where I was at the school I was doing some research in. I said, what is this? Is there something special about money? He said, no, it's not that complicated. He said, it's the only time in the service these people can get out of the pews, and they take their good time to get out so they can dance and celebrate. But and in the Pentecostal church, they had a tambourine group. A group of women, about six of them, with tambourines, and then the singing was going, and it was a celebration moment. Sometimes we think the offering time is the most depressing moment in the service because you feel obligated to give up a little bit of money, but not for them. It was the moment where they began to worship and praise and celebrate that whole moment. Now, I'd take you to Oakland, California, where I was visiting an African-American church. It was on the Prosperity side, very large church, had a dynamic woman pastor and preacher. And what they did, and some of them do, not all, but some of them do in other churches, they're very strong on tithing. And so they've turned the whole thing about money upside down. We said, keep quiet about. Don't talk about money. If you do, do it in hushed tones, and we keep it very private. No, no, no. It's over. It's the most public thing that you do in the worship service, is to display in a way or express or communicate your goals and your purpose in what you're doing with that money. So they believe very strongly in tithing. So what they do is actually, it's like a group of people who have worked hard to get to the place where they are tithing their 10% of their income. So these people are celebrated. Now, usually, you find a tither in an Anglican church, you kind of say, well, look, they're either showing off, they've got too much money, you know, and they're just trying to get some tax deductions on it or something of that sort, but keep it very private. No, no, this is a group of people that have worked to get to that place, and there are others who are aspiring to it. So what happens? Their first offering, out of two, their first offering is when the tithers all stand up and come to the center aisle, instructed to do so, and they process down and they put their tithe in the offering plate. But while they are doing that, there's about half the congregation stands up and starts applauding them. So you can imagine you're the tither and you have this balcony of encouragers who are clapping you as you come down the aisle. Pretty amazing, isn't it? And to have other people doing that instead of saying, look at that show off. No, 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 that's not a Pharisee. These people who are clapping and applauding are themselves, many of them anyway, are in the process of getting to that place because it takes a little while sometimes. And then they have their next offering and then the rest of them all bring their money down. The rest of us would do that. So you have a whole different thing. Now, some of you know that I've been doing for a decade now, I've been doing research on an indigenous Chinese group. And I started going to their church in Toronto, and I noticed there was never any offering. So after a few visits, I asked one of the deacons that I came to know, I said, what about this? And he says, I said, you don't take up offerings? He said, oh yeah, we do. And I said, where is it? He said, oh, it's a little box. And so it's never taken up in the service. So here you have just a totally opposite approach, where they actually, for them, it's very private to do it publicly. So they have an offering box usually with a cross. Sometimes it's right at the door. The registered churches do the same. I thought it was just this group. No. And so in the Chinese and perhaps other Asian cultures, I'm not sure, money tends to be a very private thing, and you don't display it. It's bad form to display it in any way publicly. So you have a whole different array of responses to it. And I'm just sharing that simply because you might find there's places where you feel more comfortable. And when you react to the strategies that the church and the schemes that we're coming up with to try to raise a little bit of money, you might get a little fussed up about that and this. But that a lot has to do with your personality and your culture around that. So let's be open regarding the strategies and let's get to the very heart of it. And I only have a very few minutes to get to that. And that's why I hope you were listening carefully to the Old Testament reading. But here you have an account of where the Israelites are told before they go into the promised land of Canaan, said, here's what you do when you get there. And so it was all laid out for them. And there were two rituals. And this morning we heard about the first ritual, which was the harvest of the an offering of the first fruits. So this was the instructions for them. Excuse me. I missed a page. There were clearly, basically, four actions, quickly. One was, go out and pick the first fruits. The first fruits are from your first harvest. Could I have some water, please? From the harvest, and you took point of it is you took your best. Thank you. It wasn't the apples that were half rotten and at the end of the apple season and were sitting on the ground under the tree. He said, well, no, that I ate the good ones, and but what's left over, that can go to the the church. And it says, pick from some of the first fruits, the best, not the leftovers, of what the Lord is giving you. So offer them to God. That's the second thing. You take them and you offer that to God as an act of thanksgiving. And the code word under that is you don't offer it to Baal. Baal and the other pagan gods were not the ones that you were to give that to, as what might have been done actually in those pagan cultures. But it goes to the altar of Yahweh, the altar of God. And then you declare why you're doing this. And this is the important thing. They declare it to acknowledge they have received the Lord's promise of the gift of the promised land. And you start to say, I declare today to the Lord your God that I have come to the land the Lord swore to our ancestors to give us. Here they personally were writing themselves into this long story that goes back to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who were the patriarchs of the Jewish religion. And the priest then takes the basket, places it before this little altar, and at that time it might have been a pile of rocks with something on top of it, simply as it's the place where God says, there I will meet you. And you place it there and you declare, and this the second declaration, I declare that my father, not their father but their patriarch, was a wandering Aramean or Assyrian. And he went down into Egypt, and it goes on, read it again to see that whole story that he laid out. And that they grew in numbers, and they suffered under harsh labor from the Egyptians. And God delivered them with a mighty hand and a strong arm, and took them into a land that was flowing with milk and honey. And that is the third action, and the fourth one is party time. You place the basket before the altar. You bow down before God, as it says. You gather the Levites. Levites were the one tribe out of the 12 tribes of Israel. God says, set them aside. They are going to manage all the religious and the spiritual activities of the people of Israel. So those were the Levites. So you take the leaders of your religion, and you take them and the resident aliens or the strangers in your land. And you do that because most of those were fleeing other countries from starvation or any number of things, and they had no means of financial support for themselves. And so you take them in. You need to hear that these days. And so they came together, and then they rejoiced, and they celebrated together for all the good things that God has given them. So I'm saying that thanksgiving is all about knowing the giver. For believers in Christ, we need to know who we are and who we worship and why we give what we give and why we give the best of what we have, and we do it first before we start paying a lot of other things. You might have to pay your mortgage and things like that, but once you can manage all of that, then it might come before that Saturday night pizza. One of our problems is that so many of us have a feeling of thanksgiving and thankfulness, but we have an anonymous donor that we think of, because we cannot name the one donor who has made it available to us. So we often feel it, and the way it expresses sometimes, so, well, I try to be a good person, or you pay it forward. Those are good humanitarian things, and please do not misunderstand me. I affirm all of that. But that is not the Christian story. That is not the story of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the people of God throughout over 3,000 years of history. You need to know what our story is. And it comes out. Listen to these declarations. There are two declarations in this one passage itself. I declare that I, and I'm bringing my personal life into this. So here are the Thanksgiving declarations to tell you who you are, and becomes the foundation, therefore, of how we are our spirit of giving. I declare that I am a loved creature of the God who made heaven and earth. I declare that I was a captive to sin and I lived as if God didn't exist. I declare that my life and the life of the world is a gift of a loving God. And I declare that this loving God came to inhabit this world in Jesus Christ. And he came to save it. I declare that life flourishes when I am living under the reign of God. I declare that justice restores dignity when mercy abounds. I declare that joy bursts forth when love has its way. That in giving my first fruits, my best, I declare that I am mirroring God himself, because my giving my best comes from the God who gives his best when he gave his only son, Jesus Christ himself. Surely there are more than 50 creative ways to get your money. Those are only strategies, but for recipients of God's love, his grace and mercy, our bedrock is our motivation and the disposition of our heart toward God. Among many other reasons why we worship God, worship shapes and trains our hearts towards God. We need to be training. We're always in training through the scripture, through, we call it the Eucharist, literally means thanksgiving. This is the great thanksgiving. Through our prayers and through our singing of hymns, which we love to do. Sometimes we need training wheels. Sometimes we have not been cultivated to have such a thankful heart to this one true God who gave us everything. And so we need to find ways, and our worship helps us open our hearts to that. Sometimes, on the other hand, we are simply bursting with joy. And I know that there are some of you that every now and again you come into church, you can't wait to get here, and you can't wait for that first hymn to just sing right, "Thank my soul, the King of Heaven." And you just sing it with all your heart, and some of you will put your hands in the air, and you can't stop praising God for it, because you're just bursting with joy and rejoicing, just as they did at the end of that ritual. When we do that sometimes, it's expressed in the words of Fritz van Opel, who was the owner of the Opel car company in Germany. And when he had had a successful experimental flight in a rocket plane that went 1.25 miles in 75 seconds, this is decades and decades ago, he said, "I myself can scarcely grasp my joy." Would there be a moment in your life when this is a breakthrough for you, and you find yourself saying, "I myself can scarcely grasp my own joy of what this is all about"? When that begins to be a moment in your life, I'll tell you, you can handle any strategy the church throws at you to get your money. Amen.